From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Robin, it is hard to make sense of some of the images that we've been seeing of beaches and pools filling up on this Memorial Day weekend, while hearing the experts say it is not smart to gather in groups, and learning about some of the nearly 100,000 Americans who have already died from COVID-19. You can't blame people for wanting to go outside, but we certainly don't want there to be more outbreaks either.
Well, businesses certainly don't want that, but they need business. So let's start the hour there. In New Jersey, new cases and deaths have dropped since April peaks. Beaches reopened on the famed Jersey Shore this past weekend, but many of them are coming up against a deadline within the federal government's payroll protection program. Now, employers have to use 75% of that money to pay employees within 2 months, or what was a grant will turn into a loan they have to pay back. Many businesses are going to hit that deadline in early June. Marilyn Schlossbach owns Langosta Lounge and other restaurants in Asbury Park, New Jersey. She's also chair of the New Jersey Restaurant and Hospitality Association. Marilyn, you've been giving out a lot of charity meals that cost maybe $5 a meal. You reopened for takeout this weekend. How did it go?
It was cold and windy and a little rainy, so that didn't help. But normally, when we have cold and rainy weather on a holiday, the hotels are full and the Airbnbs are full, so the restaurants and bars are full. This year, because nothing's open and no one's staying in these beach towns, it was much less than what I was hoping for. I mean, we always had fear that this was going to be the case if we did takeout, that it wouldn't be sustainable. And quite honestly, this weekend, it wasn't.
It sounds like a combination of the weather and then those empty hotels. It just was kind of a bust. Let me, back us up for a second, because we know you brought a lot of workers back for this reopening. Where did you stand on getting help from the government? Did you use the PPP, the payroll protection, to pay some salaries for workers to keep them on? Or did that not work for you? I mean, what position were you in?
Well, I've been a very big advocate for changing the parameters of the PPP for months now. I'll be honest, I'm a little ticked off that this wasn't dealt with last week, and now all of our legislators are on vacation this week.
Yes, Congress was supposed to take up kind of changing some of the requirements so that owners like yourself could maybe use this money for rent and other costs as opposed to payroll. Is it fair to say you were in a bit of a hole to begin with?
Yes. Paying workers is great, and that's what our industry is about, people. So the PPP could have been a viable tool if they would just extend it to longer weeks. And but the way the parameters of it now, it's tough. We took the money. We sat on it for a really long time. We pulled the trigger this week. I'm terrified that I'm going to have to pay this money back because I can't use it.
Because, again, there's not enough work to support bringing workers in, and you have to pay workers in order to qualify for this to be a grant, not a loan. So you're in this catch-22.
Yeah.
Let's say the rest of the week, people aren't going back to work yet and it's in the 80s and you do BAFO. Will you change your mind then, or is it too late?
It's too late for the PPP. We're all coming off of 3 months of being shut down with major restrictions that are going to come towards us as we reopen. Just the PPE purchasing for all the sanitizer, gloves, masks, all of that is astronomical. The takeout packaging cost is astronomical. I mean, the whole shift in how we have to do business is adding so much cost. I said to my husband, I feel like I'm launching three new businesses in the middle of my season, not knowing how to do 50% of it and not knowing what business is going to come our way. After being in business for 35 years, I never thought I would be sitting here doing this.
But as far as these restrictions, I mean, you can't put a bottle of ketchup out anymore. There's got to be ketchup packs, right? You can't have people touching the same bottle. I'm sure you also want to take the precautions because you don't want to be the owner who has an outbreak.
Well, that's a whole other story. What is the litigious liability? I'm petrified of COVID-19 lawsuits.
Bottom line, you need more help from the government.
Yes, we need funding. And I just feel like there are solutions. After Sandy, we were able to get funding through the SBA. This is like, you want to give us money to pay people to stay home, and then we have to reopen our doors with no capital. We have deferred payments for 3 months of all of our rents, mortgages, insurance, all of it that's going to hit us in July, smack in the face. if we have crappy weekends with bad weather, if we don't get open and we can't get people coming and sitting down, I don't know. You know, everybody's hopeful right this moment because we're feeling like it's going to shift in New York and New Jersey for business. But what is it going to look like in November when we haven't had enough time to recoup all this and then it gets cold and dark and we might have a resurgence of this virus?
Well, Marilyn Schlossbach, again, she owns several Jersey Shore restaurants in Asbury Park, New Jersey, a fantastic corner of the universe. I just hope that you and others are able to hang in there. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me and letting me speak my voice.
The World Health Organization has declared South America a new epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. Cases have soared in Brazil as that country surpassed Russia with the second highest number of infections, but the U.S. still leads the world in COVID-19 infections with more than 1.6 million. Joining us now with the big picture is NPR's Jason Beaubien. Jason, let's start with Brazil, which reported more new cases yesterday than any other country, including the U.S. The country's cases have now topped 360,000, even as the president of Brazil continues to downplay the virus. Now we hear the U.S. is halting flights from Brazil. What do we know about what is happening there?
So, you know, Brazil obviously got a big population, 200 million people, but it's been a very chaotic response there. You know, they've had two health ministers who have left the post in the space of a month after disagreeing with President Bolsonaro over the handling of this crisis. One resigned, one was fired. President Bolsonaro has famously dismissed COVID as a little flu. Now they've got more cases than anyone, as you mentioned, except the United States. They got over 22,000 deaths. So Brazil is really a problematic place because it's got these urban areas where the favelas, they're very densely crowded. And there are conditions in Brazil where a respiratory virus like this can really spread very easily. So, yeah, there's a lot of concern. And most concerning is the trend line in Brazil. While, you know, things are sort of plateauing in the United States, the numbers just keep going up in Brazil.
Okay, and let's go to Russia, which now has the third highest number of cases after the U.S. and Brazil. But overall, the reported death toll is low. Why is that?
Yeah, Russia seems to be on sort of a similar trajectory as the U.S. at this point, you know, with it plateauing, and they're plateauing about 10,000 cases a day. We're at about 20,000 cases a day. You know, Moscow has very much been the epicenter there, but you are getting cases all across the country. Its hospitals have really struggled to contain it. Among reported deaths, there's been a lot of healthcare workers, which is always a bad sign, both about sort of infection control and the overall management of the outbreak. But yeah, President Putin has touted their death rate as being far lower than in many other places. Most countries you're seeing around a 1% death rate. Russia, officially, it was 0.1%, you know, far lower than everybody else. The Financial Times did some digging on that last week, and they found that all the other deaths are up, but just not for COVID in Russia. And so the FT is basically saying that Russia's real coronavirus death toll is probably 70% higher than the figures that are actually getting reported by the government.
Well, interesting that you've got these two countries near the top of the list in terms of number of infections. Both have leaders that have downplayed the virus in their country, Russia and Brazil. In India, Jason, domestic air travel has resumed even as cases there surge. The country took some of the strictest measures in the world, a nationwide lockdown, more than a billion people, that started to lift earlier this month. But why are public health officials there starting to raise new concerns?
Well, so there's a lot of concern that with domestic air travel starting up again, you're going to start to see the virus move more around the country. You know, this was a very difficult lockdown to put in place, such a large country, more than a billion people, and in a country where, let's be frank, there's a lot of poor people who depend on being able to get out and earn their money on a daily basis for the work they do. So the lockdown was very difficult there, but there is concern that as this country starts to increase activity, you're going to see numbers really go up because you're already seeing a rise at this point in the cases that we're seeing out of India.
Okay. Well, then bring me to something that is a piece of good news, Jason. Where are there places that are seeing positive news? Where is the curve flattening?
So, you know, you are getting, there are countries out there that are doing it, that are bringing things down to zero. You look at New Zealand, you look at Taiwan, you know, Australia just reported only 3 cases last Sunday, just, you know, yesterday. So there are countries that are getting down to this incredibly low level. And then there are countries like Italy, Spain, South Korea, France, which had big outbreaks. And now they're still dealing with, you know, a few hundred cases a day. So they should also be looked at as good news. They have really brought things down and they're moving in the right direction. But the WHO, they wrapped up a press conference and they were basically saying that, you know, the declines that you've seen do not indicate that this is sort of some natural cycle of the virus. If the virus finds an opportunity, it will exploit it and it could come back.
NPR Global Health and Development Correspondent Jason Beaubien. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
The National Park Service is beginning to phase in access to the national parks on a park-by-park basis. The Grand Canyon South Rim opened for limited access for the Memorial Day weekend. It's one of the most visited national parks. Almost 6 million people went there last year. The Grand Canyon is among the world's most amazing natural wonders. It is 277 miles long, up to 18 miles wide, and a mile deep. It became a national park back in 1919, and last year we marked its centennial with a series of conversations, including one about how this amazing place was created by geologic events more than a billion years ago. I spoke with Wayne Ranney, who's a geologist and author of Carving Grand Canyon, Evidence, Theories, and Mystery. I asked him how it is that the Grand Canyon, an icon of the U.S. and the world, it's been a national park for 100 years, still has so much mystery to it.
Well, the Grand Canyon is a large place, as I'm sure you can imagine. When people go to the South Rim or the North Rim where the hotels are located and they look out, they're seeing only about 1/10 of the length of the Grand Canyon. So I would say that the main reason that it can't be completely understood is because of its immense size. Mm-hmm. But also the Colorado River is constantly tearing away at the walls of the canyon and removing the evidence for its earliest history.
Okay, and the Colorado River is obviously a big part of why the Grand Canyon is the way that it is, but it's not where it all started. So take us back a couple of billion years ago and tell us how the layers of the canyon formed.
Well, the oldest rocks in the bottom of the Grand Canyon are almost 2 billion years old, and there's a pretty good record of sedimentation that follows after that. And if you count up the different layers of limestone, there's probably been 8 to 10 different seas that have inundated the Grand Canyon region over those 2 billion years. And there's a huge stack of sedimentary rocks that are brightly colored, gently uplifted, and then incised by this large river. And it just proves to be one of the best places on Earth to take in a sweeping view for the long span of geologic history.
So all of the Grand Canyon was underwater many times, is what you're saying.
That's correct. Sometimes people will say, I heard the ocean was here once, and I have to correct them slightly and say, no, it's been here many times, and the different layers represent that.
And what gives the rock its red color now?
In a general sense, when we look at red rocks, we're typically looking at sediments that were deposited on land, and the iron in that sediment reacted with the oxygen in the atmosphere and gave it these brilliant hues of reds and purples and golds. And so the sea was here all those many times, but also there's a long span of history where we had terrestrial environments, things like sand dunes and river floodplains and tidal flats. And the fossils that are preserved in these layers can help us understand this long span of Earth history.
Now, the Grand Canyon is part of the Colorado Plateau, which was lifted up. The south rim of the canyon is about 7,000 feet above sea level. The north rim is even higher, about 8,000 feet. What do we know about how the uplift happened?
Well, the uplift that is responsible for the Grand Canyon happened within the last 70 million years. So we can talk about those old rocks on the scale of hundreds of millions of years, but the uplift is the last 70 million years. And this uplift was due to the fact that the western part of North America, its crust was being squeezed from the west. And when it was squeezed horizontally, the rock layers got thick vertically, mm-hmm. and that's what lifted up the plateau.
And I assume that the lift happened so slowly over time that you would never have been able to see it occur. It just happened over the course of, what, millions of years?
That's correct. I mean, you could live 10 lifetimes. You might have felt half a dozen earthquakes, but you wouldn't have noticed that you were being uplifted. But when you look through those tens of millions of years, then we can greatly uplift the Colorado Plateau.
Okay, and then we have the Colorado River, which carved the canyon. Tell us, when did that happen and how did that happen?
So one of the current ideas is that the initial cutting of the Grand Canyon was not necessarily done by the river we see today, but some of the segments that later became connected and then became the Colorado River.
So how long has the river, or whatever eventually became the Colorado River, been carving the canyon?
Well, we can go back to that 70 million year mark. And in that time, areas to the southwest of the Grand Canyon were uplifted into a huge mountain range, much like the Andes Mountains today. And prior ancestors to the Colorado River actually flowed in the opposite direction it goes today. Those rivers went from the mountains southwest of the Grand Canyon, and they went out onto the surface of what is now the Colorado Plateau.
What about wind and weather over the millennia?
Well, I think the wind is a very good agent to transport broken material out of the canyon. It's probably not a very big factor when it comes to actually breaking the rock apart. But once the other causes of weathering take effect, then the wind can carry that material away. And it's probably true that a lot of the material off of the Colorado Plateau is sitting out in the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains of North America through all these millions of years.
Now, I assume that with all of this geology in the Grand Canyon, that there are a lot of fossils that can tell us more about what happened.
Yeah, the fossils are a very good indicator of the past environments. And even though the fossils are hundreds of millions of years old, they still give a record for what was here. And in these layers of rock in the Grand Canyon, there's evidence for giant Sahara-like deserts. And in those particular rocks, these sandstones that are cross-bedded, you can see well-preserved reptile tracks. And they let us know that this area was once very arid. The layer directly below that shows fern fossils, and it can tell us that the area was humid and there were rivers running through it. I mean, it's just things are changing through time, and that's what makes the Grand Canyon so special, is that all of these things are preserved and protected. Scientists are still going in there and digging up secrets from the walls of the Grand Canyon.
So what is still unknown, or what's still up for debate about the geology of the Grand Canyon?
Oh, I think one of the biggest things that's in debate is the period of time when the rivers went opposite that the Colorado River goes today. There's about a 16 or 20 million year period where we lose sight of what the rivers were doing. So there's a period of time that begins about 30 million years ago, and then we finally get to see the river again somewhere between 6 and 16 million years ago, and it's going in the other direction. That's one of the things. There's three periods of uplift in the last 70 million years, and geologists are trying to figure out the relative importance or amount of uplift for each of those three periods. And one of the most exciting things that's happened recently is that it looks like the upwelling of hot mantle material in the western Grand Canyon is what has carved or helped to carve and deepen the western part of the Grand Canyon. And there's some lava flows that have poured over the rim of the canyon and are spectacularly preserved and plastered on the walls out there in the western Grand Canyon.
So as a geologist, is there any place on Earth that's more interesting to you than the Grand Canyon?
Well, Jeremy, I've been fortunate enough to travel to 90 countries studying geology, and I keep looking for a place that approximates the Colorado Plateau. And I guess I'm happy to say that there is no place. The Colorado Plateau is very unique. But a couple of places that come to mind are northwest Argentina on the east side of the Andes, some of the eastern parts of Morocco next to the Atlas Mountains also have similar characteristics to the Colorado Plateau. But here, the Colorado Plateau, 130,000 square miles, there's really no place on Earth that even approximates what we have right here in the southwestern part of the United States.
Do you think that in 70 million years, if the Earth is still around, that the Grand Canyon will be significantly different than it is today?
Without a doubt. I mean, if we went back 70 million years ago, the Grand Canyon region had just been exposed from under an inland sea. It was very close to sea level. The weather was completely tropical at that time. You'd have no idea that a future Grand Canyon was going to form there.
Do you think of the Grand Canyon as an American thing or
Absolutely.
Just a world thing?
Absolutely. Well, it's an American thing. I think if there were one landscape that people associate with America, it would be the Grand mm-hmm. Canyon. But 40% of the visitors here come from other countries, and that percentage is increasing. And so on the one hand, it is strictly an American icon, but on the other hand, it's a world icon.
What's your favorite thing about it?
My favorite thing about it is how it's constantly changing with respect to the weather and the climate and the time of day and the time of year. It's such a big place. The temperature difference from the top to the bottom can be 30 or 35 degrees Fahrenheit. The temperature differences between winter and summer can be up to 70 or 100 degrees. If you had an imaginary highway along the Colorado River and you drove along that highway at 70 miles an hour, it would still take you 4 hours to drive through the Grand Canyon. So as the river trip or your trip down the river unfolds, you're constantly seeing new and different landscapes. Even though the rock layers remain the same, they are exposed beneath three different North American deserts in that whole trip.
That's Wayne Ranney, who is a geologist and author of the book Carving Grand Canyon, Evidence, Theories, and Mystery. Wayne, great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for loving the Grand Canyon.
As communities across the country struggle with how fast to reopen their economies, in Wisconsin, that debate is pretty much over. Most of the state has lifted restrictions, but some cities say it's still too soon. Chuck Kornbach from member station WUWM explains the difference with this tale of two bars.
Wisconsin is near the top of states for bars per capita. Some of them have had a brush with fame. This is Club 400 in Waukesha, 20 miles west of Milwaukee. The father of renowned guitarist Les Paul owned the place. Current owner James Lindenberg says business was good early this year, and he was getting ready for a strong St. Patrick's Day.
You know, you've got your keg of green beer, which is traditional Wisconsin. You've got, you know, a lot of different Irish whiskeys that you're buying, and, you know, you got your Shamrock Shots that we purchased, Tippy Cow, made here in Wisconsin.
But on that very day, Governor Tony Evers closed all taverns.
I'll be honest, it was scary. So you shut down basically with no warning.
Lindenberg only kept a few workers around to help with cleaning projects. Others went on unemployment. Then, 2 weeks ago, Wisconsin's conservatively controlled Supreme Court said no to an extension of the Democratic governor's Safer at Home plan. And in most of Wisconsin, bars open to indoor service, with only local health department recommendations on how to operate safely. Almost immediately, Lindenberg started letting customers back in Club 400.
You know, some of the people here in Waukesha were definitely eager to get out and, you know, see each other and get a little bit back to normal.
Regular Doug Quinlan says he's glad to be back. He says he's not too worried about the virus because the tavern is doing a good job cleaning surfaces.
I'm kind of comfortable with who's here. It's a risk you take, but I always do that anyway. Just going out to the bar is a risk.
But fully opening bars and restaurants is not a risk some Wisconsin cities are willing to take just yet, including Milwaukee, where Tom Barrett is mayor.
We know that we still have a problem here. When you've got 4,300 people who have tested positive, I can't ignore that. I simply can't ignore that.
Milwaukee has also had more than 170 deaths related to COVID-19, so Barrett says he plans to keep his local restrictions on at least through this Friday. That means bars and restaurants in what used to be called the Beer City are limited to carry out only. Here at Miss Katie's Diner, the remaining cook prepares French fries for takeout orders. The Milwaukee Bar and Restaurant is a requisite stop for national politicians looking for votes. Manager Peter Pichuro says he's not happy that revenues have plunged at least 75% this year due to COVID-19. He says when he fully reopens, he's counting on customer loyalty.
The good people that have been coming here for 35 years, I think they'll be back. They're going to be a little cautious, and I don't blame them.
Pichuro and other Milwaukee business owners were also counting on a boost from the Democratic National Convention, now delayed until mid-August. But with party leaders either talking a much shorter convention or a virtual one, the financial hit to local bars and restaurants from COVID-19 could last at least through the summer. For Here and Now, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
This is a Memorial Day like no other. The coronavirus pandemic has forced the cancellation of the public events that would normally take place today as Americans honor the sacrifice of men and women who have died in the service of this country. Those men and women left loved ones behind. They're known as Gold Star families, and we want to spend some time with one of those families right now. Joining us is Tracy Volkey. Her husband, Army Major Paul Volkey, was killed in Afghanistan in 2012. Paul was a West Point graduate. He had served in the Army for 14 years, including 4 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was just 36 years old when he was killed. Tracy, welcome, and we're sorry for your loss these many years later.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us this morning.
Well, and I wonder, has the passage of time, 8 years, made things any easier for you?
I think the passage of time makes things easier, but during this time of year, sort of the floodgates come back, and all of the memories and experiences that we've had come back to the forefront, and we are forced to pause and remember our stories of our loved ones.
Just because of Memorial Day?
I think, yes, leading up to Memorial Day, there's always this anticipation that we're going to remember those times with our families. And for us, you know, we live with Memorial Day every day. Each day does get a little easier to handle, but especially during this time of year, for our family, my husband was killed in June, and his birthday and Father's Day are all in June. So this is a particularly hard time of year for our family. But we look forward to Memorial Day in some ways because our friends and family are reminding us of the warm memories that we have of my husband.
Does it help you to be able to connect with other families who are going through similar things?
I think that human connection is absolutely essential to the healing process. It has been for me and my sons. Every Memorial Day, we gather in D.C., Washington, D.C., with TAPS, an organization that's been a tremendous part of our healing. And we come together with survivors throughout the country so that we can share our stories and remember our loved ones and heal together. Of course, this year, it's going to be a little bit different. But that human connection has been essential for my family.
Tell me a little bit about something that you think of each year when you remember your husband, Paul.
I think we think of the little things. It was certainly not the easiest life to be married to someone in the military with the frequent moving, deployments, career moves. But the little things that we think of are things like how the door sounded when he would come home at the end of the day and greet my sons, Andrew and Benjamin. Just the times together and, you know, the happy moments that we had going to sporting events and being a real family.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know your son Benjamin is there with you right now.
Yes.
Can I talk to him for a minute?
Absolutely.
Hello.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. And you are 14 years old now, right?
Yes, sir.
So you were just 6 years old when your father died. What do you remember about him?
I remember that he almost like never yelled at me, and he was always super kind no matter what, and he was just a fun, caring, and sweet person.
Hmm. And I know that he sort of came from a family with a history of public service. Do you intend to either go into the military or do something like that with your future?
Well, I do have a lot of time to think about that. I definitely am interested in serving in the military and following in his footsteps, but I definitely have a long time before that would actually happen.
What do you want people who are listening to know about your dad?
I want him to be remembered in that he was just a sweet, caring person, and it hurts so much to lose him.
Well, I'm sorry again for your loss, Ben, and thank you for talking to me. Can you pass the phone back to your mom?
Of course. Thank you so much.
Hello. This is Tracy.
Hi, Tracy. So as your two sons have gotten older, do you find that you want to tell them more about their dad?
As they get older, I do like to bring up stories and memories to keep his memory fresh in their mind. The passage of time, we all sort of forget some of the better moments. And so, we do try to tell stories, look at pictures, and talk to friends who knew Paul and have them tell their stories, maybe stories that we haven't heard about him yet, just building their collective memory so that they can continue to hold his memory tight in their hearts.
For Veterans Day back in 2009, your husband wrote a newspaper essay that was published that talked about why he decided to serve, why he decided to join the Army. And he wrote, "There are two reasons. The first is that I love helping people. And the second is that the people I serve alongside, soldiers, Army civilians, and sailors, airmen, and Marines too, are a truly amazing group. They represent the best in all of us. Dedicated to their nation and their comrades, they are selfless and loyal, and I consider myself fortunate to be among them." What do you think when you hear that?
It's funny that you brought up that quote, because my husband's mother had that printed out for me after he wrote it, and I keep it in my office. I'm currently a Army civilian. I work in legal assistance helping Army families and surviving families, and that message is what I go back and read every Memorial Day, every Veterans Day, and it's what motivates me in my life to continue and work as hard as I can for our nation, for their families, their military families, because he was right. They do represent some of the best humans we have in this world, and it makes me understand why he did the job that he did, why he was so dedicated to the job that he did. And it makes me have a little bit more understanding as to what he sacrificed for.
There are so many Americans, including probably some who are listening to this, who think about Memorial Day as the day to have barbecues and go to the beach or whatever. What do you want just ordinary Americans who may not have a personal connection to the military to think about on this Memorial Day?
I think that, yes, it is a time for us to all pause, and I'm glad that the country has this, most people have this day off, to sort of pause and think about our families and think about the sacrifices that our military's families make with constant moving and changing jobs, and how the children have to readjust and reestablish their life every few years, and then they have to endure long periods without a parent. It is not just the sacrifice, but it's living that military lifestyle followed by that sacrifice that is so important that we remember and honor those people that have made that ultimate sacrifice.
That is Tracy Volkey, whose husband, Army Major Paul Volkey, was killed in Afghanistan in 2012. We've been speaking with Tracy and her son, Ben, who's 14, Tracy, thank you so much, and please thank Ben for us as well.
Thank you so much for sharing the story.
And you can see a family photo of the Volkes at hereandnow.org. The song we're listening to is The Legionnaire's Lament by the Decembrists. Tracy says it was her husband's favorite.
As bars and clubs reopened this weekend in Houston, images of crowded parties flew out on social media, followed by hundreds of complaints about the lack of social distancing those pictures showed. Houston's Mayor Sylvester Turner has now warned of enforcing stricter guidelines on businesses. And what about graduations? In Texas, many school districts are going ahead with outdoor in-person events, some with no guests, some with social distancing and sanitizing. Not everyone's happy. McKenna Tanner is a graduating senior and one of the valedictorians at Houston's Stratford High School. She wrote an editorial in the Houston Chronicle titled, "High Schooler Wants Graduation Postponed Until the Data Says It's Safe." She joins us now. McKenna, we know you've had both positive and negative responses, but what is the school saying about the ceremony?
So my school itself, they're limiting how many people are allowed to come with each graduate to the ceremony itself. They're planning on making masks with the school logo on them that they're expecting every graduate to be wearing throughout the whole ceremony.
What's the limit, by the way? How many can come?
I believe it's four.
That's four times, in your case, what, over 500 in your class?
Yes, that's a lot of people. They say they're going to make efforts to social distance, but I am concerned about the logistics of it.
Well, in fact, you're right. You think it's going to be impossible to prevent hundreds of human contact starved seniors from ignoring their instincts and, you know, wanting to hug their friends. I mean, that's an image from graduation, running across a stadium into the arms of a friend. That's your concern.
Yes. We had a car parade for the seniors, and there were people afterwards in the parking lot who are hugging and taking pictures together. And it's a very real and human and understandable desire. It's just that because this is so natural and innate, we can't expect everybody to not do that. And we can't expect our teachers to keep everybody from doing that because there are too many of us.
Right. They're going to be outnumbered. You also point out that Texas's COVID-19 numbers are not dropping. As of May 19th, the cases in Houston are 1.2 times what they were a week ago. So there's been an increase there. Texas has had a spike since the economy started opening. And your point is that means we don't have the virus under control. When you say you want the data to dictate this, what would make you feel safe?
If we could actually see that we're not having an increase in the number of new cases every day. I mean, we talked about flattening the curve a lot when this was first starting. We have a flatter curve, maybe, but it's not anywhere near something that shows that we have a stable level, something under control. So I think we need to try and see we're not increasing every day, and that's going to come with social distancing and having it easy for everybody to get tested.
And it sounds like you're not as worried about yourself, but about, you know, parents and grandparents who may snag one of those tickets.
Well, yeah, I mean, the big concern is the other people who are going to be more at risk for the complications, and it's especially dangerous for the people who would really like to be at these ceremonies and who maybe will try and make it anyway. And it's important to recognize that and try and help them as well.
But what about, you know, that sense of there are people who really feel like it's a rite of passage they've been looking for their whole lives at this point? This might be the last chance they have to have some kind of a ritual like this. And there's a concern that it's just going to peter out. If it goes too long, which it might have to get that data you want, you know, people will have moved. You're just not in the same place, and it may never happen at all.
I mean, yeah, I know. I realize that that's a possibility. I really would love to have a graduation. It crushes me that we might not. But I'm also looking ahead and thinking, like, I really would like to be able to start college on campus in the fall. And I want to be able to go back to seeing people and getting together with people. And I can't be sure that that's going to happen unless we're looking for opportunities to try and bring the virus down now, sooner rather than later, by doing what we can now as much as possible.
Is there a chance you won't go?
I know that there are some people who are considering not going, and it's something that has come up as something my parents and I need to talk about, but we're only just now getting some ideas of how it's going to run. I really don't know yet.
It's a tough decision. Your thoughts on what your generation and what the class of 2020 has been handed here?
We've got everybody in the world almost looking at people who are the members of class 2020, both in high school and in college. And everybody has ideas about how much stronger we're going to be and how resilient and all of these characteristics that they're imbuing us with. We would like as much as anybody to just have things be normal and be the way they're supposed to. And they're not, and we're handling it as best we can.
Well, all I know is that when this is in the rearview mirror, it will have shaped you in some way, and we'll find out. I feel pretty confident in you guys. And we thank you for speaking to us about it. McKenna Tanner, senior and one of the valedictorians at Stratford High School near Houston. Her op-ed in the Houston Chronicle titled, "High Schooler Wants Graduation Postponed Until the Data Says It's Safe." McKenna, best of luck to you, whatever happens.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.